Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
It's sort of a given that the rich and beautiful take better vacations and wear better clothes than the rest of us mere mortals. Do they also have better functioning lungs and spleens? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We used to just strive for good health, a body that works the way nature intended and is free of pain and disease. But in recent years, the word wellness has taken on a different meaning. It's a commodity. It's often sold in the form of luxury products and treatments that make a lot of pseudoscientific promises about detoxifying and purifying our bodies, and it's priced high enough that striving to achieve wellness is a status symbol in and of itself. Amy LaRocca is a writer and editor at New York Magazine. You can find a link to her article, The Wellness Epidemic, at think.kera.org. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about all this. Amy, welcome to Think.
Hi.
What is wellness as you define it in this essay?
Well, obviously wellness by itself is a fairly basic concept. It's striving to be healthy in your mind and your body and your spirit. And there's nothing particularly new about that. What I found interesting about it is that it's suddenly a commodity. Now, my background at New York Magazine has been largely covering the fashion industry. And what was so interesting to me about wellness was that the way in which wellness was being marketed to women, just like the luxury goods connected to the fashion industry have been in my, 17 years at the magazine. So wellness had really become the sort of main luxury commodity seeking to exploit all of our insecurities and neuroses about, are we keeping up? Are we doing enough? And it was very similar to me to fashion and how fashion has been sold to women.
Well, that's really interesting because I may know that I can never be 6 feet tall and beautiful in a supermodel way, but I can detoxify my colon like the best of them.
Yeah, you sure can, especially if you purchase some very expensive items to help you do that. So I think that part of it is burnout. You do, as you said, you know that you can't make yourself taller, you can't make yourself younger, you can't make yourself any number of things. But these are ideas that are presented as attainable. You can be pure, you can be cleaner, a lot of the words that are used are words like pure, words like clean, conscious, mindful, and well. And those are something that on their surface everyone can seek to attain those qualities.
I was thinking about it over and over reading this piece. It's almost as if this movement suggests that privileged people shouldn't accept that their lives might contain pain or the effects of aging or disappointment the way everybody's life does. It's as if they desperately want to think they're above it.
I don't know. I'm a little less critical of people than that. I think I'm a bit more sympathetic. We all have pain and we all have suffering, and we all seek to avoid it and lessen it. And we all, nobody wants to get old. Nobody wants to get sick. And I think wellness is capitalizing on those very basic, very primal fears that we all have. And the people who are in the position to take advantage of that are the people with means. So I think it's a very human instinct to want to take better care of yourself, to want to think that you're doing everything you can to be healthy, to be well, to avail yourself of everything that's out there. I think where I get a little bit uncomfortable is that these items are incredibly expensive and the outcomes are pretty nebulous. I mean, there are certain things, like a lot of the doctors who participate in the wellness movement are what's called functional medicine doctors. And they really seek to take a holistic approach to your health, really look at the root causes of disease and find out how they got there. And a lot of the functional doctors I spoke to said things that are really, really, really hard to disagree with. Like, maybe you need to take time to relax. You have this disease and I'm going to treat it. I'm going to give you antibiotics if you need them. But maybe you also need to take some time in your life to be with friends, to be with family, to take a little bit better care of yourself. Now, who could argue with that, right? I mean, those are just very basic things about taking care of yourself. Get some exercise, get some sleep, get some fresh air. Sure, I find it a little terrifying when suddenly there's a huge price tag attached to something that you do or don't need to achieve a sort of balanced whole life.
So you anchor this piece around Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle website, which is called Goop. Yeah. And it used to be like vacations and restaurants, and then it's moved very much into wellness. I want to just listen to her.
Oh, it's so medical, yeah.
Talking to Jimmy Kimmel last month.
So one of the things we like to do on Goop is find kind of what the alternative world says about, like, you know, feeling good in the modern day world. So earthing, I don't actually know that much about earthing, and it came out of me not knowing anything about earthing, but hearing about it. It's kind of, they say that we've lost touch with sort of being barefoot in the earth, and that there's some type of electromagnetic thing that we're missing.
That
and
is
so
true.
It's good to take your shoes off and walk in the grass.
Okay.
I don't know what the we talk about.
Okay, so everybody likes walking around barefoot in the
yeah.
grass, but wellness from Goop does not come cheap.
No, I mean, you know, so it's sort of like, sure, if somebody says to you, you know, it might feel great. You might feel great if you just took off your shoes and walked in the grass. Like, could you argue with that? Absolutely not. But suddenly there's a lot of, and Goop is not alone in finding ways to charge you huge amounts of money to do these kinds of things. So, like, are we disconnected from nature? Absolutely. Is that problematic? I mean, potentially it really is. Is it something we need to pay a lot more money and become a lot more neurotic about achieving? That's where the wellness industry sort of kicks into its sort of bonkers mode, and it's hard to really sustain it. So, you know, for example, one of the main things on one of the most popular things on Goop in the past year was a piece about postnatal depletion, which is a condition that women who after women have children, they find certain reserves of certain vitamins and minerals in their system are a bit depleted because they've gone to the creation of the fetus. That has been going on as long as women have been having children, and the body over time will replenish those supplies. And, you know, women are exhausted after having children. I think that's been going on as long as women have been having children. It's an exhausting process mentally and physically. So Goop identified something that we all can, you know, everyone knows about both scientifically, anecdotally, experientially, and came up with a vitamin protocol, a very expensive vitamin protocol that it promises will fix your postnatal depletion.
Are we really feeling as bad as we think we're feeling? I mean, people who don't have an actual health concern.
Question.
Yeah.
This is the question. Are we feeling that bad? And this is, you know, I'm very sympathetic, and I don't want the piece or my research to come off as you know, cynical about this. And I think the more and more I spoke to people, the more sympathetic I did become to the fact that people really do believe themselves to be very, very sick. People are really suffering in ways both emotional and, it would seem, physical. I mean, certainly there's allergies. Children have terrible allergies. There's a rise in autism rates. There are autoimmune diseases that you've sort of never heard of before. Everybody seems to have celiac disease. So the question is, are we being overdiagnosed? Were we previously being underdiagnosed? Or is there a sort of postmodern malaise that's affecting everybody and creating very real sadness, pain, and suffering? And, you know, I think, yes, there does seem to be a great deal of suffering, whether imagined or real or some combination, or in the end, does it matter if it's imagined or real, if people really do believe themselves to be ill on some level?
Well, it's really interesting because some of the people who are targeted by this marketing are the people who, almost as a matter of course, we can assume that they have access to, you know, conventional healthcare, right? And we have
yeah.
a whole segment mm-hmm. of Americans who don't. And it seems
yeah, and I think that's where it gets really difficult, because it's a really sort of, I find it's just inherently grotesque to be talking about this kind of healthcare, to be engaging in it when healthcare is just being denied to so many people. And I think that very, very basic fundamental healthcare, and I think, you know, this country is getting more and more and more and more divided. So while not wanting to belittle the suffering of the people who do have the means, it is, I think, just another huge symptom of the divisions, the cultural divisions that are happening in this country. And so it's a very hard thing to kind of take seriously some of these complaints that people have when it tends to be the population who has access to really excellent care.
How is it that people who have access to excellent care in some cases seem to not trust it?
You know, that's a really great question. And I mean, you see that across cultures. you know, why are really educated people choosing to not vaccinate their children, for example? There's a real sort of anti-science distrust movement that can be really, that does find itself connected to the wellness movement in a lot of ways. Why are people so distrustful of scientists? Educated people of means really are sort of scared. And I think it has to do with fear and paranoia. And, you know, there's this funny moment where someone pointed out that Alex Jones' InfoWar website, like the sort of, you know, home of the right wingers, and Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, suggest a lot of the same treatments. And, you know, they're packaged very differently, but what they're promising is the same thing. And I realized, like, it seems like the only place the right and the left are getting together right now is on paranoia. Everyone thinks we're getting poisoned all the time for totally different reasons. But on the right and on the left, it's a fear of contamination. I think that really fundamentally, if you really just like take it down to basics, I don't think this movement would exist if the smartphone didn't exist. I think that the smartphone is so exhausting and draining that's really the basis of this movement having legs. I mean, there's these for-profit meditation studios in New York City. Now, there's always been meditation available in New York City. It's been a bit sort of crunchier, more of a fringe kind of thing, maybe smells a little bit like patchouli, and it wasn't popular. It was a real sort of fringy kind of thing. And it was also frequently free. It's a kind of ethos of the meditation community. Now there's two really beautiful, really well-designed meditation studios that are competing for customers. And, you know, it's sort of the thing people say about them is they want to be the soul cycle of meditation, you know, this highly stylized thing. And you go in and you have a meditation class for 30 minutes. I think it costs about $18. And they're, you know, they're beautiful spaces. They're really calm and they're very, very well-intentioned. And, the main thing is that you can't bring your cell phone in. You can't bring your smartphone in that room. And I don't think that could have existed as a business in the days before the smartphone, because I don't think the need to disconnect existed. I think you disconnected if you were walking from your office to the subway. You had 10 minutes to be by yourself and be quiet in yourself. And that space has completely collapsed. And, you know, and then you add in social media and all the kind of social anxiety, status anxiety, who am I, where do I fit into this? And I think that's really, in my opinion, the basis of why this stuff is able to really seize people.
Well, it's interesting because I think everybody would agree that cell phones are now a tool that we consider indispensable. They were, at least at the beginning, a status symbol. And we acquire these things and then we realize that they also have a consequence, right? They might make us more stressed.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of companies. I was speaking with a friend the other day. We were talking about vacation. I said, well, how much time do you get off in the summer? And he said, oh, we don't have vacation. This is a very successful person who works for a really big New York City company. He said, we don't have vacation anymore. Vacation is no longer a concept. I can go wherever I want. And I can be in south of France with my family all summer long if I'd like to. But I need to be available every minute of the day. Every minute that I'm there. They don't care where I am. But like, so, you know, the whole notion of vacation is sort of collapsed because you can go, sure, but you need to be on. And that's a very different model than you previously had. You'd work really hard at your job and then you took off maybe 2 weeks in August to be with your family. And during that time you were on vacation. Those ideas have collapsed. So is it great that you can be anywhere? Yeah, that's completely great. And that's opened up a lot of freedoms for people and made it possible for people to live their lives in really different ways. But it's also collapsed any barriers and made it very difficult to actually turn off. So the idea of being away as restorative has really collapsed.
My guest is writer and editor Amy LaRocca. Her article, The Wellness Epidemic, was published last month in New York Magazine. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Magazine writer and editor Amy LaRocca. You can read her article, The Wellness Epidemic. It was published last month in the magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Amy, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You mentioned that you write mostly about the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. Is there something about wellness that makes it more likely to be targeted toward women than men?
Well, yeah, for sure. You know, who is more paranoid about the way they look and take care of themselves, men or women? I mean, I think women have always been more susceptible to, you know, thinking we're not doing enough to take care of ourselves, thinking we're not looking after ourselves well enough. Someone else is doing it better and you should try and keep up. A lot of these things are anti-aging. One of the things that's really interesting about wellness is vanity is sort of excluded from the conversation, but very much present. So, for example, juice cleansing, which was kind of one of the early wellness trends, no one ever was saying that you were going to lose weight on it. It was the marketing was always very, very, very much, oh, you're going to give your colon a rest or something, which doctors are like, what are you talking about? But it was always, you're going to purify yourself. You're going to get rid of these toxins. You're going to do this and that for your gut, your microbiome, whatever it was. And then the women who founded it said to me, we never mentioned weight loss, but let's face it, it was a liquid diet. And that was obviously a motivating factor for a lot of people who wanted to participate. So a lot of it is about beauty. It is about weight loss. And those are certainly areas where women are much more susceptible than men.
Yeah, this made me think a lot about the self-care movement. And I don't have a mm-hmm. problem with people taking care of themselves. But it almost becomes, when it's treated almost like a form of hygiene, it's like a personal responsibility. And if for some reason you fail to live up to the, you know, extra rules that are inherent
in this.
Yeah,
just another thing to feel bad about,
right?
Yeah, no, I know for sure. I mean, you know, at one point I talked about this in that article, I ran into a woman I know who used to own a fashion boutique in the West Village here in New York. And she said, no, I've converted, you know, fashion made women feel so badly about themselves. I would just be in the store and I would watch these women and they felt like they didn't have the body or they didn't have the money or they didn't have the lifestyle for these clothes. And I just didn't want to participate in that anymore. And I've converted my space into a natural beauty center. And so you should come have a look. So I went and, you know, had a facial. It was a lovely experience. And then got an email and they were trying to sell me $1,000 worth of beauty products. You know, a $300 moisturizer, a facial mist that was going to do this and that for me. And I was, you know, years ago said to my dermatologist, what kind of moisturizer should I use? And she said, use this from the drugstore. That's all you need. And then you start thinking and you get panicked. Oh, God, you know, am I giving myself some horrible disease with this drugstore moisturizer? What am I? Do I not value myself that I'm using this $12 CeraVe and clearly I should be using this $300 thing? And am I falling behind? Is everyone else going to look radiant and I'm going to look, you know, like a crone because I didn't use the $300 face cream? So you can see how it sets in motion all the same anxieties as fashion.
You know that some big companies are beginning to include wellness as a corporate perk, which is fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not some big companies. I think pretty much every large corporation has a wellness program. And in a lot of situations, the benefits department is no longer called benefits. It's called benefits and wellness. And yeah, I think that what's interesting is that it's a retention question. I think that those are the kind of perks that people in corporate environments have come to expect. And it's, you know, if J.P. Morgan is offering a wellness program, Goldman Sachs is going to have to offer one as well. And, you know, so they're all doing it. Arianna Huffington actually left the Huffington Post to start a company devoted to wellness. And one of the things she does is implements wellness programs in large corporations. And as she said, it's not for the people who want to chill out under the mango tree. Like, those people are fine. This is about people who really want to get things done and make some money and be in the corporate world and engage in the corporate world and really maximize their potential. And that's the goal of a lot of the corporate wellness programs, is to get, you know, the best performance out of their employees. And, you know, it takes all different forms. It's yoga, it's meditation, it's retreats, it's all, you know, everything you could imagine. But yeah, I would say it's become a really, it's almost an expected part of the corporate world.
We actually had Arianna Huffington on the show to talk about the book that she published a couple of years ago about the importance of sleep. And
yeah.
There was a lot in it that was, you know, really solid. On the other hand, when she described her personal ritual for getting a good night's sleep, that felt really unattainable to most people. You know, the silk sheets and the special
curtains. Well, you know what?
Curtains.
It's exactly. I've got young kids. I've got two little kids. And, you know, it's exactly what you're taught to do for your kids. So, you know, I do a whole version of that every night in my house. It's just not for me. It's for my children, you know, where you turn off the lights and you have your song that you listen to and you have a warm bath and you listen to, you know, you read a story that's not connected to the rest of your day. It really is. I couldn't believe that when she described her sleep ritual, it really was just sort of exactly what I had just gone through in training toddlers. It's sort of almost the same routine that, you know, your pediatrician recommends for a kid.
Is there a flip side to the sense that we need wellness strategies to make us feel good? Because I was thinking about the old fable about the princess and the pea, right? Normal people are not sensitive enough to feel that little dried bean under 14 mattresses.
Yeah.
But royalty, they're much more refined and they need this more than everybody else.
There is for sure a princess in the pee factor, and I think just having the luxury to feel your pee is a is a pretty big deal. You know, a lot of people have to get on with it and maybe don't have time to perform some of these rituals, don't have the means to perform some of these rituals, and therefore can't go looking for these problems. But, you know, again, as I said, like I really don't criticize anyone for feeling that they're suffering or for feeling that they're exhausted. I mean, the modern world is hard. You know, life is hard and suffering is part of it. And I think everyone feels it in their own way. And this is, you know, it does sort of, you know, get your back up a little when you see the different ways it's being exploited and those insecurities and those difficulties are being used to sort of take advantage of people's suffering. But I don't question the suffering at all.
Are physicians worried about the effects of this movement at all? Is it leading their patients astray in cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly some doctors who treat populations who you know exist in these worlds where they might be having access to this kind of thing. I mean, I know when I go for my physical, I've got this great GP and she goes through her sort of checklists of things she asks everyone. She goes, please take me no supplements, right? Just tell me you're not taking any supplements, because she really, you know, doesn't believe in that, and she believes in a balanced diet, whatever. And I think she does spend a lot of time with patients who are self-diagnosing and taking all sorts of stuff that she wishes they weren't putting into their bodies. So I think that I think it is difficult for certain physicians to deal with that. I think a lot of good physicians are interested in the kind of functional medicine approach, which is, I think, a really, really good physician does treat the whole patient. And I don't think that that's necessarily a new concept. I think certainly you have physicians who are stressed, busy, overloaded, all these other things, you know, might not have the luxury of being able to address their patients, don't see their patients enough, all the rest of it. But I think that most physicians probably at their core would like to have a more holistic approach and really treat the whole person. I think that's, you know, a lot of why people get into medicine.
Do doctors who've incorporated some of these more alternative health strategies into their practices with conventional medicine, do they believe that there's a biological value to these treatments, or do they see the benefits maybe working like placebos?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's probably different for everyone. I think, you know, Frank Lipman, who's one of the real pioneers of the functional medicine movement, really came to it because he saw benefits of acupuncture at an addiction clinic at a hospital in the Bronx. So, you know, he really believes in acupuncture, as do a lot of, you know, a lot of doctors really have had great results in acupuncture. And I think for all of them, it's different. I do think that a lot of doctors believe in the kind of basic idea that they would like their patients to take really sort of basic common sense care of themselves, get enough sleep, get away from their phones, eat well, you know, eat whole unprocessed foods, get some exercise, get their blood flowing. I mean, really sort of basic ideas. But, you know, as for the different specific, you know, whether or not Reiki or acupuncture, I mean, I don't know. I think that really varies from case to case.
You know, it's funny because those three legs of the stool of good health, which is eating right, exercising, and getting enough sleep, they're so simple, and yet they're so hard for us to actually incorporate into every single day.
It's very difficult. It's really, really, I mean, that's what I mean. Modern life is hard. You know, you've got a lot of pressure. But at the same time, if you're a person of means, you have unprecedented access to, I mean, when in the history of the human species could you get, like, every fruit and vegetable delivered to your door in an hour? I mean, it's like, you know, we have access to really sort of phenomenal means of taking care of ourselves if we have the time and the consciousness to access them. And I think it really does come down to it's the time and the consciousness to access them and you know, and then keep them basic.
Presumably people who have the resources to pay for, you know, wellness that is not strictly medically necessary, have enough money and also have access to education. Why would these people maybe be susceptible to pseudoscience and skeptical?
That is a great question. I don't know. The women who founded Blueprint would tell me that sometimes they would worry because there would be a lot of press suggesting that maybe juice cleanses weren't so good for you. And doctors pretty uniformly came out against juice cleanses. Like every time there was journalism on the topic. And their business only ever went up. So I don't know. I don't know why people are susceptible to pseudoscience. I don't know why people think they know better than science in a lot of situations. A lot of people in the wellness world would answer, well, you know, Western medicine and conventional medicine have been around for a long time and they're really well funded. And there's all these studies. So you Western medicine, conventional medicine likes to point to numbers. Alternative medicine has never had that access to studies and the ability to generate data. So there's just a feeling among a lot of the really, you know, alternative practitioners of alternative practices that those practices just haven't had the opportunity to prove themselves. And if they were given the same opportunities, they would certainly have spectacular results.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and editor Amy LaRocca. Her article, The Wellness Epidemic, was published last month in New York Magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I went poking around on the Goop website just because I was curious, and a lot of the products that they sell do use doctors to make claims. There's a pretty picture, usually of a woman doctor, talks about scientific properties, but then there are these disclaimers in tiny print saying this statement has not been evaluated by the FDA and is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I wonder if that's not a deterrent, if people see that and almost say, well, if the FDA doesn't know anything about this, maybe it's worth trying.
I think people like the idea of being ahead of the game, having something no one else has access to. And so, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of doctors who believe a lot of different things. And, you know, medical science doesn't agree on all things. So, yeah, a lot of doctors have really pursued alternative concepts. And I don't know. I think it's just the feeling like you're kind of in on a secret, a little bit ahead of the game. I mean, Goop says that they're just trying to arm their readers with alternative information that enables them to go into their doctors and ask some questions. And they don't want to replace the doctor. They want to give women the ability to ask questions. And I think, you know, there is historically women haven't always been treated spectacularly by the medical establishment. So, you know, you can see that there's some distrust that certainly women's ailments in the past have been shrugged off or belittled. And so, you know, they have that to kind of as precedent.
The other reality is that, you know, if someone like Gwyneth Paltrow is beautiful. And I'd rather not believe that that's just the product of good genes and good luck and think that, you know,
if you could get it.
Right.
If you could, like, you know, if we could, who wouldn't want to live her life? Her life looks great. And she looks like she's really enjoying it. And if that's because she has got her chi in balance and her other, you know, whatever, her thyroid and her viruses, I don't know, then yeah, who wouldn't want that life? She's a perfect spokesmodel model for this movement. And I mean, you know, every movement, it's not like Americans have not had sort of health-based movements before, and there's usually a sort of charismatic role model. And I think she's a great charismatic role model for this because she looks great. She seems to be having a wonderful, wonderful life.
Yeah, when I was in my 20s, I would buy skin cream and think, it must work great because my skin looks fantastic. And I didn't really associate that with the fact that I was just very young. And of course it did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Lisa is calling from Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me. First of all, this topic is so fascinating. I really enjoyed listening to the conversation. And I think, just a quick comment, I think people are just looking for a quick fix, something to do it quickly or with a lot less pain than actually working out and eating right. But my question is, where do you think the balance will come between the two, the more holistic and alternative or the traditional? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Amy? Hi.
Oh, what do I think? Well, I think that sort of up, you know, anyone who has access to these things, I would be very surprised if people really, like, you know, that many people start giving up their access to traditional medicine. Although, you know, I don't know. I'm surprised by the anti-vaccination movement and how strong that is among educated people. So you know, I guess I really don't know what the limits are. And I think that the caller was absolutely right about the quick fix thing. I mean, who doesn't want to say, oh, for postnatal depletion, apparently it's, you know, very common for women to have a very low calcium store for a number of years after giving birth. And that's something that rebuilds slowly over time with, you know, weight-bearing activity and a healthy diet. Wouldn't it be nicer to take a pill and just know that it was done? So, yeah, of course, the quick fix factor is in. And, you know, I think in cases where the medical answer is not quite as satisfying or the traditional answer isn't quite as satisfying, people will always go looking for alternatives.
You feel like you're doing something.
Yeah.
My guest is writer and editor Amy LaRocca. Her article, The Wellness Epidemic, was published last month in New York Magazine. We're going to come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer and editor Amy LaRocca. Her article, The Wellness Epidemic, was published last month in New York Magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink. That's where we hear from Tanya, who writes, one of the things not being discussed regarding conventional versus alternative medicine is the power of the pharmaceutical industry on doctors. I guess there is, Amy, this sense that maybe doctors aren't telling the truth because they're in the pocket of big pharma.
Yeah, and I think that's a big fear. And I think we were talking a little bit earlier about paranoia and where paranoia comes from is, I think, a lot of fear about the pharmaceutical industry is out there. And I think it's, you know, very justified. We all know how powerful Big Pharma is as a lobby. We all know how much money drug companies have made off of all of us. And that is something that I think frightens a lot of people and leads to people questioning, questioning their doctors, questioning science, that there's a lot of money involved. Of course, there's a lot of money involved on the other side, too. So,
yeah, and sometimes you note in the piece, people who are really suspicious of conventional medicine accept without a lot of questions this magical formula in whatever they've been sold.
One of the things that is, like, you know, the enemy of the wellness movement is wheat and gluten. Like, no one wants to go near bread. And it's like a loaf of bread is like this poison you would give to a wellness person, but give them a pack of vitamins that's, you know, not regulated by the FDA and could really have just about anything in it. Like, best case scenario, you're just going to pee it out. And they'll just happily take them. But like, offer a loaf of, you know, baguette, it's like poison.
All right, back to the phones now. Morgan is calling from Dallas. Hi, Morgan.
Hi. I have a question on this idea of biohacking that's like really trendy coming out of Silicon Valley. I know my husband is like really getting into these podcasts from like Tim Ferriss about the ideas that you can change your DNA by the things that you put in your body. How dangerous mm-hmm. do you feel like these claims are?
Well, I mean, how dangerous any of these alternative therapies are is really like up in the air. So much of it is harmful. I mean, who's going to quibble with meditation, for example? That's just not going to do anything bad to anybody if they're attempting to practice transcendental meditation. And you know, attempting to sort of, people say that if you meditate enough, you can change your neural pathways and sort of change your brain. That seems to me like a really safe place to start if you're interested in wellness. I think once you're putting unregulated substances into your body, you know, I don't know what the risks are. I don't think anybody knows what the risks of these different things are. I think it could be pretty dangerous. So I think like for people who are interested in wellness and, you know, feeling unhappy or feeling like they could be doing a little bit better, you know, how about the meditation route or some of the sort of more basic, get yourself back in touch with nature or take a walk or take a nap or connect with a loved one? You know, this kind of fundamental stuff is, I think, a sort of safer place to go.
And we have an email here from Casey in Venus who notes that, you know, meditation and mindfulness are more affordable since she doesn't have access to affordable mental health care.
Well, let's also point out that meditation is actually free. It's something you can pay for now, but you really don't need anything to put yourself in a quiet, still space and just disconnect for 20 minutes. I mean, yeah, meditation is really a great place to start. I mean, there's a woman I interviewed for this piece who has like this line of really beautiful bath salts, and they're billed as digital detox bath salts. They're really nice. They smell great. They have clay in them and they're wonderful. But the instructions are, leave your phone in another room and then take this bath and don't go back to your phone and then just get right into bed. And the bath salts are kind of expensive, but that's also something you could replicate very cheaply.
So I can go to CVS, buy Epsom salts,
yeah,
and leave my phone
you
in the kitchen.
You could even just have a bath,
right,
with nothing in it.
You attended something called The Class, which is kind of a star in the genre of wellness classes these days. Talk about what happens there.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so, yeah, I went to The Class, and Taryn Toomey, who leads it, is an incredibly charismatic woman, and she really has a following here in New York. I mean, people are just devoted to her class, and I really didn't know what to expect. And I was kind of shocked. I mean, when she comes into the room, she just starts screaming. And the women in the room, and I mean, she's screaming things that I cannot repeat on the
Thank
radio.
Thank you for that.
And she is, she's screaming things, and the women are screaming things, and they're like beating their thighs, and they're having this total catharsis. And the movements itself, it's a hard class. It's a difficult exercise class, and you get really, really, really sweaty. But, you know, I mean, you do a lot of jumping jacks, you do sit-ups, you do like some very basic rudimentary yoga moves. So it's not so much that the class is so difficult. It's that it's a mind-body experience. And Taryn herself is on this headset, and she is just talking the entire time. And it's about your relationship to yourself. It's about, you know, why do you think you can't do that next push-up? Is this a story you tell yourself in your life? What are these lies you're telling yourself? How can we get back? You know, there's really like, you know, therapeutic, cathartic experience of women just in this room sweating and screaming their heads off.
And you
will love it.
You found yourself feeling guilty because you were like, this is probably really good for my glutes. And then you thought
yeah.
I don't think that's why I'm supposed to be here. Or
no,
maybe it is.
Not supposed to be here for my body. I mean, you know, and I go regularly to a Soul Cycle class in my neighborhood, which, you know, I used to take spinning a really, really long time ago. And it'd be like, you know, let's get your butts lifted for summer or whatever the kind of thing, motivational things your instructor would say. But now in my Soul Cycle class, it really is like, you know, who do you want to be? Think about who you're here. What are you riding towards? They never, ever, ever, ever mention your body. It's all an emotional, sort of spiritual experience, exercise.
You seem like a really thoughtful person, so I know that you're probably aware that the fashion industry, fashion journalism, gets blamed a lot for people feeling bad about their bodies and their appearances. What do you do with that, and do you think it's a reasonable criticism?
You know, I've spent a long time in the fashion industry, and I have great, really, mostly very positive feelings about that industry. It's complicated. Though it is, I do think the rise of the model as a cultural figure has not been great for the international self-esteem of the female gender. But you know, you do start to see that changing a little bit. A little tiny bit. You know, I think the fashion industry and how people look and how people want to look—it's been around forever. And I think if we can get away from this sort of monolithic idea of beauty and what it is to be fashionable, what it is to be beautiful, the more we can move away from that and into fashion as a more inclusive world, the better off we will be. And I do see the industry changing a bit in that direction.
You mean just different kinds of bodies being featured?
Different races being, you know, being put on runways, being put in editorials in magazines, different bodies, different races, different price points for clothing, you know, a lot of different things that fashion has become much, much, much more democratic. When I first started going to fashion shows, there was no one there, and you would see those clothes and no one else would see them. It was very exclusive. Hmm. Now I can see a show in New York and you can live stream it in Dallas that very same day. I won't see it a minute before you do. And I think so things like that are making people feel more involved, like it's a less exclusive thing. You can buy clothing online. You can buy clothing at a variety of price points. There's high design. High design is not limited to the highest price bracket in fashion any longer. You have Karl Lagerfeld doing a collection for H&M. You have, you know, there's just been, it has become in the years, close to 20 years I've worked in the industry, far more democratic. It has a long way to go, and it is still fashion, but there is movement in that direction.
How much thought do you put into what you will wear to a fashion show?
How much thought 20 years ago when I started, and how much thought now?
Is there a difference?
oh yeah, for sure. You know, ultimately the fashion industry is quite small, so everybody does kind of know each other. In the beginning, when you're starting out, you don't know anyone. I think it's probably a lot more intimidating than once it's a bunch of old friends.
And when we think about, you know, things that we can buy to make us feel better, mm-hmm. are there things that you looked into that you thought, you know, I don't know if there's science behind it or not, but I kind of like it. You know, you went to one place where there were supposedly like crystals in the floor that were supposed to vibrate and help you be your best self.
I don't know that I got any vibrations, but, you know, I think that, as I said before, it's meditation, it's the sort of emphasis on disconnecting from your phone, not participating in social media. That kind of stuff I really, really, really think is healthy and I'm all for. Those also tend to be the things no industry is going to make any money off of. So those aren't really the wellness concepts that I see being advanced hugely. Because there's no money making in them. But I think a lot of those ideas are really, really, really great. You know, I'm a big believer in science. So when it comes down to like what I'm going to eat or what I'm going to put on my skin or what I'm going to use to wash my hair, I'm pretty trusting in science. I'm pretty trusting in what my doctors tell me. So I tend to stay away from that stuff, but I do think that the notion of disconnecting and how that connects to wellness is a really compelling idea.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and editor Amy LaRocca. Her article, The Wellness Epidemic, was published last month in New York Magazine. You know, another thing that this really points to is the fact that maybe we feel like we need permission to disconnect. Like if we can say, I'm not doing this because I just want to, but I'm doing it for my health, that allows other people to give us the space to not do what everybody else is doing.
Absolutely. And I think like with the digital detox bath, if you say, oh, I'm going to take a bath, you probably have your cell phone in that room with you, but you say, I'm taking a digital deep detox bath right now, and this is a whole sort of process that I'm participating in. Or not, you know, I'm going to go sit in a quiet room by myself, and I'm not going to bring that phone in that room with me. You might not do that, but I paid $18 for a meditation class, and my phone is not allowed past this point. You would probably, you know, it is, it's permission. It's also, it's naming it. It's naming your disconnection time.
And do you think that men are maybe not far behind in the pressure to look and feel a certain way based on the way that these things are marketed to us?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think men are definitely included. I think men are just less susceptible, less likely. I think a lot of the marketing language and a lot of the companies that are really focusing on wellness are companies that target females. But I think men are definitely... definitely going to be participating in wellness movements and definitely susceptible to a lot of the sort of anxieties.
You mentioned that you have children. Are they very young?
Yeah, they're very young.
Okay, so you haven't
they're
started having
6 years old.
These conversations with them yet, or maybe you have.
No. They're too young for that. No. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very disconnected in a very good way. Yeah.
But it's the pressure to do all these things begins
young. But, you know,
young.
My 6-year-old wants a phone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
you know, it's not going to happen, but she's definitely aware.
Did you grow up in New York City?
No, I grew up in the suburbs of New York City.
Okay. So is there a real difference living in the city from growing up elsewhere, do you think, in terms of the amount of stress in daily life?
Not necessarily, I don't think. I think that I didn't grow up in the country. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up in the sort of New York City area. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it's like. I've never lived in a rural environment. I've always been New York City connected. So I don't really know. I mean, I don't know if you live on a farm in Vermont or if you grew up in a small town in Maine, what kind of pressures you would feel. But I would imagine they're different.
Did you hear from people about this piece in the magazine? Was anybody just furious?
I did. Nobody was furious. No, nobody was furious. I think that, you know, because as I said, I mean, I really am really sympathetic to the idea that people are suffering, that people feel sick, that people are concerned about their own health and the health of their children, and that the environment they're living in is unsafe. And I think that's a really... sort of sad comment on modern life, and I don't dismiss it, and I try not to be too cynical about it. I can get really cynical about the attempts to capitalize on it, but the condition itself I really have a lot of sympathy for.
Amy LaRocca is a writer and editor at New York Magazine. You can find a link to her article, The Wellness Epidemic, at think.kera.org. Amy, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. We had Alan Roberts on the board today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. My personal Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.